GUI, I think, was just the default template, the slides, and the one that you could actually leave out. I guess I accidentally made a joke. So the subpoints, how do we handle subpoints? So if we wanted to allow a point element within a another point element, okay? See how this works, subpoints? So just like in any slideshow, you might have a dot, you know, a bullet in there, indents, and a couple more bullets. So how would we do this in our style sheet? This is what we want the output to look like, so we want a list within a list. We want to recursively allow list within list within list. Maybe we want to allow it as deep as possible. So it's necessary. So here's how we would do that. For the subpoints element, we just do a UL for unordered list, and then we say apply template. Okay. And it will have as its children point elements. We already have a rule for points, so that will be invoked automatically. We don't have to add a rule for points. If we wanted points within subpoints to be handled differently, then we could just make a rule, point, subpoint slash point. Right? But if we don't care about them being handled differently, then we can just use the existing point rule. Whenever you add a template, you have to think, will this template be called? Because if you do not have an applied templates in the parent element at the appropriate point, then it won't get called. If you have like a value of, or if you just didn't have any applied templates, that rule would never get called. Just like in a programming language, you don't want to add a function without thinking about what you're going to call the function. Well, in this case, it turns out that, yes, we already have a point rule, and the point rule already calls applied templates. So what will happen is that if you have a point within a subpoint, the point rule, executes for the top level, and then the subpoint rule, and then the point rule, and then the subpoint rule, and then the point rule, and again, they'll go on and on recursively until it runs out of elements in the document, in the input document. So this is what it looks like visually. Point goes to list item, subpoint goes to unordered list item, unordered list, point goes to list item, et cetera, and go on and on. Okay. Now let's look at another SSL instruction. So we've looked at apply templates and value of, two of the more important ones. Now let's talk about for each. So for each, you can probably guess what it does. It does a for loop, just like in some sort of shell scripting language or something like that. So it loops over many different nodes, and then it does something for each of those nodes. It, essentially, the for each has a sub-template within it. It also has a template within it. That template is instantiated once for each match. And every time it's instantiated, you get a different context node. Different for each node. Let me show you what that means. Here I have a rule for repairs. Okay, so it's just a template rule. And then I have a table element, creating some kind of table element and some vocabulary. And then I have a for each select all repair element within the repairs element. So recognize this as the example that we kind of started with. Output a row element. Now in here I'm getting the value of the date, but that's relative to the repair element, not to the repairs element. Because it's within the for each. And if there were 100 repair elements, this code will be run 100 times. This template will be instantiated 100 times with a different element as the context node, the current node every time. So you'll get date, location, but a different date and location every time. Okay. Does that make sense? The important thing to remember is that you've changed your current node. If you want to get back to the repairs element, you have to use dot dot or something like that.
This template matches all repairs elements, no matter how far down they are in the list, yet the for each only applies to repairs elements that are in the
group. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, actually, what you would probably typically leave this off. Yeah. And just leave that as Warp Pillar. That's a good point. But typically, you would just do a coil each of Warp Pillar. Of a relative.
Another question. What's the difference between doing that and making the template match?
Right.
Prepared slash.
So when would you use foil each and when would you use a template? I think you can always use a template to do the equivalent of a foil each. But it can be more convenient to use a foil each. One reason is that people are a little bit more used to thinking in terms of looping than in terms of templates. Another reason is that it can help you to kind of centralize the code that's dealing with, you know, a particular part of your document or something. It might just be a little bit extra effort to abstract something out into a separate template.
Templates contain templates?
No.
Okay, well that would be one reason.
Right. Another reason is that if you already have a template for a pillar, because you can sometimes want to, as I said earlier, you sometimes want to process the same element many different times. If you already have a template for a pillar, then to make a second one, there are ways you can do it, and you can call the second one and so forth, but it's easier maybe to just do a foil each in one case and a template in the other case than to try to make two templates and then disambiguate them. That makes sense? When you cannot use the foil each, the time when you must make another template is essentially when you're dealing with recursive structures. So if you have a non-recursive thing, then you could just do the whole thing in a foil each containing foil eaches, containing foil eaches, containing foil eaches, right? But if you have points calling subpoints, calling points, calling subpoints, points and subpoints and so forth, then you need the template so that you can get the recursion going. Just like in a programming language, right? You can get away without functions for the most part until you need recursion. Does that make sense? But the recursive case is so common in XML that you usually have to get to using templates pretty quickly. Okay. So I've already kind of given you a little bit of an introduction to this concept of recurrent node in the for each. There's a little bit more syntax than I've taught so far. I'm going to go back and teach some of this syntax later. But there's this thing called the current function, which will return the current node for you. And that's occasionally useful to get access to the current node. There are times when in these square brackets, which I'll talk about in a little bit, where the current node is not, where the context node from an XPath point of view is not the current node from an XLT point of view. I'll go into that in more detail later on. Okay. So conditional processing, just as in a programming language, you'll want to be able to do things only under some certain set of conditions, so if. So here we have the XSL colon if statement, which says if test, and when it's testing is if there is a figure element anywhere within the current element. Okay? So test, all test does is say if this thing is true, then process the body. And in this case, you can see that I only want to do a table of figures if there are actually figures in the document. It's kind of embellishing the table of figures and then there's nothing there, right? That makes sense? So first I check if there's a list of figures and then I output the text and then I process the figures, you know, in the dot dot dot. That makes sense, everybody? Okay, and XML colon choose is more flexible in that it's more like a switch statement or something. What it will do is try each of the things in order. So, let me see about an example. Here's an example of a choose when something, do the first thing, when the other thing, do the second thing, otherwise do the third. Again, I'm going to go into these predicates in a second. So that's That's pretty simple. It's just that, it's just like a bunch of if statements in a row. And then finally otherwise for if none of them match. And it just chooses the first one that matches. Probably has that one. Okay, so what I'm going to do, just based on how the timing is going, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit and then come back, because I wanted to do some more of the expat stuff. I wasn't sure if I would have time to get into more of the expats, but it looks like I will. Let me just clear this. So the bottom of 63, we're going to jump to the bottom of section of page 63. So it should look something like that. So we're going to go into a few more advanced XPath features. Some of the things that we didn't get to before with XPath. We're still not going to be able to cover everything in XPath and everything in XLT, but a little bit more sophisticated stuff. So the first concept that we're going to discuss is a predicate. A predicate is a feature that allows us to filter result node sets. We selected all the elements of type P, and then we wanted to only choose the ones that had a particular attribute value. We could do that. Or only the ones with a particular sub-element. So, predicates are specified within square brackets. We'll talk about those in a second. And the most common types of predicates are checking for attributes, particular types of attributes, checking for sub-elements, and checking the position of a node. So if it's the first or the last or something like that. So here's an example of an attribute predicate that checks for the security attribute being top secret. So you put predicates in square brackets after the thing that you're looking for. And what it does is filter out any nodes such that this thing does not return true or some particular node. So in this case, it's going to look and see whether the section element has any security attributes. Of course, you can only have one, with the value top secret. I'll talk a little bit more about the types of operators that are available in a second. Here we have the list of sections that have any kind of security attribute. So if you just ask for a node, it'll just check whether that node exists without comparing it to anything else. This is just checking whether there is a security attribute on the section. And the ones that are, the sections that do have the security attribute are returned, and the ones without the security attribute are discarded. This one checks for security attributes on sections and then returns the name attribute from those sections. So you see the difference between the square bracket and the slash. In this case, I'm actually returning the name attribute after I've checked whether it has, whether the parent element has a security attribute. That. Okay, so here we are checking for all section elements that have within it an image element. So because I did not have an attribute, an at sign, I'm checking for a sub-element. In this case, I'm checking for all sections all section elements that have an image which in turn contains a caption.
Can you use the dot dot here?
Yep, you can use the dot dot there. By default, again, it means dot slash. If you put nothing on the front, it means dot slash. If you wanted, you could put a slash there at the front, and then it would check not whether this section had an image caption, but whether there existed an image caption at the top of the document, or you could have slash slash, and check whether there was an image caption anywhere in the document. I mean, it's not really, really useful to choose sections such that there exists an image somewhere in the document that has a caption, right? But if you combine that with something else, you could say, find me all sections such that my attribute is equal to some other attribute somewhere in the document. So if this attribute exists anywhere else in the document, then do something with this section. Otherwise, if it doesn't, then ignore it.
What's the difference between a sub-element predicate and just using the double slash at the section?
Okay, two things. The first is that a sub-element predicate is a direct, it's only looking for direct children, so it's more like the slash than the slash slash.
Okay.
And the other big difference is what is returned. So if you have slash section slash image, you're returning the image. But if you have slash section square bracket image, you're returning this section. You're just checking if it has an image.
That's another five things.
So with another question?
So is there a way to return it? You that list with the, let's say the names and the unique and then all of the.
Yeah, let me just think about that first section. So you want, the thing is that, XPaths always return nodes. And nodes kind of by definition are unique because they have a position in the tree which is unique. What you would really want to do is to return nodes with some attribute that is unique, I guess. And I can't think of a way. There's a feature for doing that in a global sense for the whole XSLT document. But not within an XPath. There's a feature I think I'll have notes on later where you can do uniqueness with globally for the whole document. Okay. So positional predicates, they use the same syntax, but they're a little bit different in what they mean. This says, return me the third section element. So it returns me the third, it forcibly selects all the sections and then it counts to the third, of them. This will collect all the sections and then return only the last one. The other ones are filtered out.
And if they don't have anything,
That's right. If you don't have anything, you'll get an empty list back. Again, XSLT is really kind of loosely typed. It's really, it tries to give you an answer all the time instead of giving you any other message. So if you ask it for the third and there isn't only two, it will return, nothing. It is one base. It counts, starts counting at one, not at two. This one will return the second last section, so it returns the last minus one section. Okay. And this will return the third subsection of the fifth section of the document. Does that make sense? So you can put a predicate at every level, not just at the endmost level. You can put them in the middle, too. So what can you put in a predicate expression? You can put other location path expressions. So you can, we've done that with the sub-elements and the attributes. Those are other location paths. We can put strings in there if we want to compare against strings. We've done that. If you want to compare against numbers, you can do that. There are operators including OR and AND. I think we'll have a slide about those in a minute. And there's a bunch of functions that you can use. That define the next path. So the called functions, there are a lot of them. You can look in the XPath specification. It would be educational to look in the XPath specification at the list of functions to familiarize yourself with all of them. But here are some of the major ones. The node set functions, for instance, ID. We'll look in the DTD for an ID attribute and try to find an element with a particular ID. You are deeply bullish in XML node, then you know what ID means in that context. Otherwise, you don't need to worry about it. Last, we'll return you, we'll find the last, node in a list of nodes, and that's how it's used in the predicates. Position will tell you what the position of the current node is, if it's in a list, if it's in a list of nodes. Count of the list, number of nodes in a list. String functions contains allows you to find out whether a particular string contains some other string. Starts with tells you whether a string starts with another string. Normalize will normalize white space. If there are things, places where there are two spaces or a space in a new line, will normalize them all to a single space. There's some Boolean functions. You can check, for instance, if the language is, you know, English, EN, or EN colon US, and so forth. You can hard code true and false. You want to compare against them, for instance, say if this value is equal to true or if this value is equal to false. Number of functions, you can convert something to a number. You can do summations, you can do rounding. So summation is adding up a bunch of nodes that represent numbers, rounding or round, a number off to an integer. Okay, so equality operations. Oh, yeah.
There are two cases that I'm curious about how you create a predicate for. One, if a node is empty, has no children, and it's simply empty node, and the second other node exists in existence.
Why not if it exists? In what context do you want to know if it exists, I guess?
Well, maybe,
let me answer the first question and see if it answers the second one. I think I have
a slide.
Yeah, I don't have a slide. There's a not function, should be the list of Boolean functions, which you can surround an expression, and if it does not match, then you get a true. You know, it reverses the value of the expression. So you ask if it had no children, that would be not asterisk. The asterisk will return the children if there are children.
Not parens asterisk.
That's right, not parens asterisk. So that's an example of how you would check whether anything exists. I mean, usually just asterisk will tell you whether a thing hasn't, and not will tell you it doesn't have any children. Well, if you want to check whether it had a paragraph child, you would put a P. If you want to check that it didn't have a paragraph child, then you would say not plan P.
That also tests for text types on it?
Asterisk will not check for text nodes. You want, we'll get to unions in a second, but that would be not plan asterisk or, so the union, the text. So we'll get to unions in a second. You could also, if you're mostly interested just in text nodes, then you could compare it to the empty string is another way to check that it has no text. Okay, so some equality operators. Equal tests if two things are equal. It will usually convert them to the same type. So if the one is a number, then it will try to convert a string to a number and so forth. It uses, again, it's really loosely typed, it will try to convert things to the same type. If they're both strings, then they will be compared as strings.
Which side does it go? Does it say, okay, the left hand side is string, then it will try to put it right to string? Is there a precedence?
Yeah, there's a precedence of types, so if one of them is really a number, then it will try to convert the other to a number. But if, whichever side it goes on. But if, one of them, but if they're both strings, then we'll leave them both as strings. So it doesn't matter which number, which side it's on, it's which type it is. So equal will compare two numbers to make sure they're the same, or two strings, or we'll convert a string to a number and do the comparison if it needs to. Not equal is the, you know, the opposite of equal. Less than and greater than, I think only for numbers, not for strings. I check this, but I don't think it does any kind of less, it does any opposite less than or greater than. And then less than equal and greater than equal, you know, is a combination of less than and equal. Okay. There's also Boolean operators. All of them means to test whether one or the other is true or both. So I'm looking for a section that has a title or that has a name. And here I'm looking for a section that has a title and a name. So it requires that they both be, available at the same time.
An on that?
No, there's no extra. So if you go back to your logic class, there's some way to construct it, but I can't remember off the top of my head. So numeric operations, operators, if the operand can be interpreted as a number, then you can use these. So if it's a string, but it has only numeric digits in it, then you can use these. So plus will add, minus will subtract, two numbers, div will divide, asterisk will multiply, and mod gives the modulus, so the leftover from the division. Can anybody guess why we use a div for divide and not a slash? We can convert explicitly between types, and I would encourage you to do that if you know that you're going to be dealing with one type or another. So number will, you wrap an expression in number will try to convert it to a number, so string to a number, for instance. String will convert it to a string, and Boolean will convert it to a Boolean. So expressions, they will turn nodeless, evaluate to Boolean true if the nodeless is not empty, and evaluate the new Boolean false if the nodeless is empty. That makes sense. So if you do a search for, if you do a Boolean colon asterisk, again, it will check whether this node has any children, because asterisk is the wild card, and it will return true if it does, and false if it doesn't. Or if you say Boolean colon at sign foo, then if the thing has a foo attribute, it will return true. Logical unions. So here we have, we are selecting the set of elements of type A and unioning it with the set of elements of type B. The difference between this and the OR operator that we discussed before is that this puts two sets together. The OR only returns a Boolean that says yes or no. Yes. The thing you're looking at is in this set or in this set. One of these things evaluated true or false. This will actually build you the set of A's and B's put together. So here we are looking for the set of elements that are either A's or text notes. Show me the set. So if I want to do some further processing on it, I have this as a set, not just as a Boolean. So someone asked about if they wanted to check whether an element had either sub-elements or text nodes, you could do this. A or text would check whether an element has either sub-elements or text nodes. Okay, so XPath has the abbreviated syntax that you've seen, and there's also this thing called the unabbreviated syntax, which is less rarely used, less often used. The basic idea of the unabbreviated syntax, this is kind of the underlying data model of XPath. You can think of it that way. And in the unabbreviated syntax, you have every step is thought of as three pillars. An axis. So am I interested in looking at children? Am I interested in looking at parents? Am I interested in looking at descendants? A node test, which is name of the thing you're looking for. So I'm looking for the attribute named foo, I'm looking for the element named p, I'm looking for the namespace named XSLT or something like that. And then the predicates we've already discussed. In the unabbreviated syntax, instead of saying slash foo slash bug, you say slash foo slash child colon colon foo slash child colon colon bug. So you're explicit about the fact that you want to go down to children. And instead of saying at foo for attribute foo, you say attribute colon colon foo. Okay, so it's a long way of saying it without all the kind of syntactic shortcuts. You do not have to use this very often in day-to-day use. That's why it's not the default kind of syntax you'll see in most XSLT style sheets. If you're doing really complicated stuff, then you might have to dig into the full axis syntax. Most do not have to worry about that.
And I'll confuse you more than help you.
Okay, so now we're going to jump back. So that will give you a relatively good sense of what's available in XPath. If you want to go into more detail on XPath, I'd suggest you just look at the XPath specification. It's relatively readable. Some of the things about the axes and so forth can be somewhat tricky, but especially the functions, most people can understand the definitions for the functions relatively easily. Things like the string functions, the number functions, and so forth. You can go into a lot more, you can learn a lot pretty quickly on those things. Also, there's an excellent book on XSLT, of course by O'Reilly. And there's another one that's also good, by Michael Kay is another famous. Okay, so let's, go into a few more advanced XSLT features now that you've got the kind of the basic model down in your head. This is an XSLT instruction called XSL colon element. And what XSL colon element does is generate an element. What you would do it in this way is if you wanted to compute some part of its values. If someone asked about what if I wanted to compute H1, well, you could compute the name attribute here, which is coded voice, count plus one or something like that, to generate the element type name. And, in the namespace, you can do the same thing. Instead of having hard coding it, you could compute it, maybe from the input on or something like that. So this is a more verbose way of doing just literal result elements, but gives you more fine-grained control also.
Not use this to insert nodes in current
No. XSLT does not allow you to modify the input document at all. Logically, it always transforms from an input to an output. If you had a particularly intelligent implementation, it might figure out a way to reuse the input document. But as a model, XSLT always uses for help.
Can XSLT take two input documents or always one?
That's a good question. There's always a primary input document, but there's a function called document and XPath. It's an XPath function, but it's defined in the XSLT specification, which allows you to follow any URL and pull in other data. So you could either HUD code in your XSLT, a file name, usually you wouldn't do that, but you could, you know, or you could, or URL, you know, remote URL, or you could, have an XSLT that, it reads the XML and then it looks in there for a link to some other XML and follows that link, and then you can even recursively follow other links and so forth.
So in that way you could actually modify the input document on the fly.
You're really interested in modifying the input document. No, you can't modify the input document.
No, but if I'm pulling in chunks on
you can pull in chunks on the fly and you can kind of make it seem like you're expanding the input document. But you're still not actually changing like the bit stream of the input document. So yeah, that document function is pretty powerful for working with hyperlinks, where you want to follow one document to another. So that's how I would do multiple input documents. I'd make some kind of wrapper XML that has pointers to all the other ones, and then follow links to them.
Okay. So what you're saying is you've got no guarantee that the parser's not generating the document.
Can you speak up a little bit?
With XML, you've got two ways to parse it. One is doc, the other is tokenizing the interrupt. Sacks parse with the doc.
Okay, you mean sacks and the DOM, right?
Right.
And what would your question?
You're not guaranteed that it isn't a DOM parse or parse.
Right, in fact, it probably is. Sometimes it's a more efficient DOM parser that throws away the information doesn't need for doing XSLT, but it is usually some kind of DOM is used in the background of the XSLT implementation. Okay, so now on to attributes. If you have wanted to compute a particularly complicated attribute value, this one's not that difficult, but you know, if you had something that wouldn't fit easily into those little curly braces, you can use this XSL colon attribute element, and then you can put whatever you want inside of it, and it will be pushed into an attribute of the containing element. Okay, so I could have, you know, hello world, and then value of, and it would make a source attribute on the image element with that value. So you can make a compute of truly complex attribute value. In this case, it's the same as this, but in a more complicated case, this might be a simpler way of doing it than doing all this, than trying to fit it all in code in place. So the text, we discussed briefly the XSL colon text element. This is text. All that will do is output this is text. The primary reason you would do it that way is to totally control the white space around it. This is text. If you had white space there and there at the beginning and the end, it would ignore that white space because it's not inside the text mode. Whereas if you just had text, it would probably, if you had just had this is text and in context with white space around it, then it would treat the white space as being attached to that text. So let me give you an example. Let me see if I have an example of that. Okay, so this blah text would have associated with it this new line in the white space and this new line. So if you wanted to get rid of that extra white space, you could drop it in XSL colon text explicitly to say this is the beginning and ending of the text that I'm interested in. And as I said, if you wanted to actually add a new white space explicitly, then you can do that. So you could just say, put four spaces inside of an XSL colon text and it'll output those four spaces. Because if you have spaces that are not attached to any text usually, it will figure the whole thing is just white space, right? If you have a node that consists of nothing but white space, it will throw it away. But if you put it in the XSL colon text, knows not to throw it away. You know, it's just white space, no other text. Okay, so XSL colon number. We won't go into a lot of detail on this. I will do point, 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 point. Just so you know what's available, you can look at the docs to understand it in detail, because you can see that there's a there's a lot available. So I stop on numbers for numbering. Things like paragraphs, figures, examples, and so forth. You can do numbers of the form 1.1, 1.1, 1.1, 1.1.1, and so forth. You can do multiple levels and so forth. You can how to count the particular elements, which parent element to use to start the count. Don't remember off the top of my head what the attribute does. The format, you can tell it, you know, how to use dots and commas and uppercase and lowercase and Roman numerals versus the Latin numerals and so forth. You can give it a language, if you're using letters, you can tell it whether to use alphabetical letters or I actually can't remember what the traditional distinction is. This will tell it whether to use dots or commas to group sets of three digits, like if you get into the thousands and so forth. And this will say, you know, to group size in the thousands and the millions and so forth. So most of these features you would never use. It's essentially these first three will do the majority of it for you. Okay, inserting a processing instruction. So a processing instruction is a little thing that starts with less than, question mark, and so forth, and she's a few of them in her notes. This would insert a processing instruction with the href equals book.css, type equals text CSS. Something kind of odd looking here, because processing instructions are not elements, and attributes in processing instructions are not kind of a first class XML concept, they're just a convention. So all SSLT knows is that it's outputting this text, href and type, and then the fact that someone will interpret those later as being like attribute values is kind of outside of the scope of SSLT. You could just as easily type, you know, hello world in here. It doesn't have to look, processing instructions do not have to look like elements with attributes. It's just a convention that's really common. Yep.
You can put PHP code there, couldn't you? If you did name equals PHP. And then
just in that section. Yeah.
If you were processing it to make it into one other thing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think you could. Okay. Here's a comment, so if you wanted to generate a comment on output, this is the usual kind of comment I put in. But you can put in any comment you want. Again, it's just whatever text you put inside of it becomes a comment. You could also use instructions in there, value of or whatever, but usually it's just text. Okay. So, on to copying. There's two different ways of copying elements provide a way for you to not know so much about your input document and your output document. You don't have to hard code it to the same level. You can say, whatever element I find, handle it in this way. And what copy of does is, copy a chunk of the input document to the output as is, without any further processing. Okay. But XSL colon copy only copies the current element. So whatever the current element is, just copy the tags for that essentially. Not the full recursive copy of everything that you do with XSL colon copy of. Let me see if I apply to that. So here's a copy of, I do a select. In this case, I'm finding a bar element inside of a foo element. I'm going to take that whole node tree and copy it into the output as is. Okay. I'm going to talk about variables more later, but in this case, I'm copying a result tree fragment from a variable. I'll talk about that in more detail. Okay? SSL copy is for copying the code node. So it's different in that you're not saying, find me that thing and then give me a complete copy of it. It's saying, hey, I'm going to put a P element. I know I'm going to want to create another P element. I know I'm going to want it to be in the same namespace. So please just copy this for me. Or you can imagine the case where you use this with a Google match asterisk, right? So you don't even know what the clone element is. It's a lot easier to use XSL copy than to use other complicated features to figure out what the clone element type's name is and generate an element and so forth. Okay. So this will just do a copy. Notice that namespace nodes automatically copy attributes and children or not. So if you want the attributes, then you have to explicitly copy them. Okay. Just the tag, the element type itself is copied automatically. Okay, on to variables. Variables are just like somewhat like in a programming language in that they allow you to create data to reuse it later. Okay, so variables can be numbers, strings, booleans, node sets. These are the basic XSLT types. And they can also hold so-called result tree fragments. So a result tree fragment is just essentially the result you get from applying a template. So here I am saying, hello, my name is, and then I get a computer name. Put all of this inside of a variable. Now I can output that multiple times. I can just put that anywhere in the current scope, right? Let me just quickly check the next slide. And the two ways of using it is either to have the content inside of it, the thing that you want to be the variable value, or to have a select attribute instead, and then that becomes the variable value. So, here we have a template, and I'm doing a variable, naming a student name, and doing a select of name, right? So, that will find me a name sub-element, and assign it to the variable named student name. Then if I wanted, you know, five times in that template to refer to the name, I wouldn't have to recompute it over and over again. So here we have $name, it's used once there. $name is used once there. And so forth. $name is used again down there. So as you can see, the variables are referred to with a meeting dollar sign. Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah. So, that makes sense to everybody? Sure, that should have been student name. Select is, name is the element type name, but student name is what I've assigned the building. Okay. So parameters, okay, before I go on, let me refer to a question I got during the break. Someone who's been using XSLT for a while said he wanted to overwrite a variable value. XSLT does not allow you to modify a variable once you've created it, okay? The variable value is fixed. It's more like a constant, really, but it's a variable constant. it's a variable constant in the sense that every time you run a particular template, the variable that you defined will get a new value, right? But you're not overwriting the variable. You're creating a new variable every time with a particular value. Just like a local variable in a programming language, right? Or in most programming languages, that variable gets created every time with a new value. It's the same in XSLT, but the difference is that if you have another XSL colon variable statement later on, it will not update that value or overwrite it. And you can't say that I like, if it was an integer, a number, you could not say that I want it to be plus one of what it used to be. You can't use a count or anything like that, because that would be updating the variable. You make a new variable with a new name, which is one more than the old variable, but you can't update the existing variable. Is that clear? You're used to a functional, if you ever use a completely functional programming language, it's like that. You override variable. parameters. Parameters are like variables, except that they are designed so that you can send information in from the outside. So you can send information to the style sheet or to a particular template from whatever is running the style sheet or whatever is running whichever template is calling this template. So if you use a top-level parameter for a style sheet, you could set it in through command line arguments. That's really common if you're using a command line processor. If you had a GUI, you could send it in through a GUI. If you set environment variable, then you file, doesn't matter. XSLT doesn't make any distinction, but all it cares about is that you have a way of specifying it. So command line is a good way, or an API if you're doing it from a programming language. If a parameter is not specified with a value, then it defaults. It's some kind of default value. Here's an example of a param called foo. We would refer to this just like we would a variable called foo, which is dollar foo. Parameter is a variable, except they can be passed in from outside. And it says, hello, my name is, and then it gets the value of the name attribute. Okay? So, if you did not specify this, if the person who called this template did not specify this parameter, I think I'll have a slide that shows how to call the parameter in a second. If they did not give a value, then it defaults to this text. Hello, my name is, value of selected name, it would process it, right? So that's why parameters are just like variables, except that the caller can specify them if they want. And if you have a parameter that has neither the content nor the select, then it defaults to the empty string. That's the fallback. If you haven't told it what value to use, then it defaults to the empty string. Yeah, so the next slide will show you how to pass in a parameter. So there are two instructions you can use to call templates. There's the one called apply templates that we've gone through in detail. We talked a lot about apply templates. But there's another one called call template. And what call template does is call a template by a template name instead of by a template, instead of doing the matching trick. Call template is like a function call in a programming language. Just, here's a template, it has a name, just call it directly. Don't worry about matching anything. And the other big difference between call templates and apply templates is that it does not change the current node. So with apply templates, you know, it does that trick of finding all of the sub-elements and then looping through them and so forth. Call template just says, call this other thing, whatever's the current node now will remain the current node. So here's an example of a call template. Calling to call a template named foo. So the template will also have a name attribute that says foo. So say x is our calling template, name equals foo. And then if it has a match attribute as well, that's irrelevant. In this case, now it only cares about the name if you use call template. I'm telling it to call with param name my param 1. So I'm giving it a parameter value. I just talked about parameters a second ago. This is how you pass parameters. And I'm giving it a value. I could do the same with an apply templates. Again, I can say with param give it a value. In this case, I'm using select. I'm using the same pattern of either select or content. Pass with parameter. You can choose either model depending on what type of thing you're trying to pass. If you're trying to pass a node list or something computed entirely from the other document, from the XML document, then you'd use select. If you're trying to build something, you know, some text or something, then you pass the content, you know, literal result element. Like you could say, hello, my name is, as text. Then you would pass the content. Right? Okay, so this is another kind of advanced feature. It's called modes. So modes are a way of, you processing the same element in many different ways over and over again. So let's say we wanted to process an element as a heading, and then again as a table of contents entry, and again as an index entry, and again for cross references. So I might want to have 4 or 5 different templates for all of those different types of ways of handling that element. And what we can do to have those different templates, one way to handle it would be using that feature I talked about just now, where you name a template and call it explicitly. But then you give up all the nice benefits of applied templates where it finds the templates and so forth, right? Instead, I would rather attach a little string to a template called the mode, which says, when I'm in the table of contents mode, this template applies, whereas when I'm in the index entry generation mode, this template applies. Even though they might have the same match attributes, the templates would otherwise clash with each other, but for the mode attribute. So, what I do is I just add a mode attribute, like for instance the string TOC table of contents or the string index for indexing and so forth. And I do apply templates, mode equals TOC, and then it will automatically find the template that's in that mode. The select works the same as it would otherwise, but it only finds, it selects template rules that are within a particular mode. It's like a way of dividing up your style sheet into different groups of templates that work together. Mm-hmm. So here I have an example of a template that I'm a match called section. And I have another match called section, but it's in mode TOC. So when I'm processing the book, first I match all the templates, identify templates in mode TOC, which will select this rule for each section. And then I do a plain old apply templates, which will select this rule for all templates. So sometimes you have, XSLT. If you do a lot of XSLT work, then you will build up a set of functions that maybe apply to the sorts of document types that you're interested in. But you don't always want, but you might have multiple places you can use the same element. So you want to reuse parts of it. Just like in a programming language, you want to reuse modules. So you can do that. You split up your style sheet into multiple style sheets and then include and import them. So here's an example of where I'm including one using a URL, an absolute URL. And here's one where I'm including a relative URL. Okay? Style sheets may not include themselves directly or indirectly. Can imagine how that would cause a problem if it tried to import itself recursively. Import is slightly different than include. So include is really simple. It just takes all those template rules and kind of promotes them to being in this style sheet. So it's like pound include in C. Takes all that junk and imports it through, and includes it directly. Import is a little bit different in that the style sheet, the XSLT processor remembers which style sheets it started with and which ones were imported later, and it applies them in order. So the top level one is processed first. And so if you have a template rule that matches in the top level one, then it will take precedence over one that matches in the second level one. So you won't get clashes. So essentially the include is for where you know exactly what's in that other one and you kind of control it completely. The import is for where you say, I know this one handles some elements that I also handle, and I know that it handles some elements that I don't handle. So let it handle the elements I don't know how to handle, but give me complete control of the ones I do. So it's nice, especially if you have a style sheet that's already finished and you just want to tweak its behavior, you can import it, override a couple of templates, you know, and yours will take precedence over the one you imported. Okay, so these features, these are related to some of the things that people have asked about today. One is XSL key, is used to define a searchable index into an original XML document. So let me give an example of when this is useful. Let's say you have a list of employee records. So each element represents some employee, and you want to index them by employee number. You can do that so that you can look up one like very easily by employee number. You can do that with pure XPath. You could look up with pure XPath for an employee with a particular employee number, but with the index you have two advantages. One, it's slightly faster because it knows in advance to compute that index, right? And two, you don't have to use as much syntax because you specify the syntax for the key in one place. This is how I figure out the key of an employee. And then you can refer to it everywhere. So we'll see an example of that in the next slide. These are some of the other features that we'll cover in this section. So as I said, employee by employee ID. You could have employee by social security. You could have multiple keys on the same element. There's no problem, but over the same sets of elements, there's no problem with that. So here's an example. We have a bunch of employees, and they each have an employee ID. They also each have a social security number. Maybe they have some other information. And down here I have them organized by department. So I'm going to want to look them up in here based on their employee ID for any particular department. So here's a style sheet with a key. The name of the key is employees. It matches any employee element. And the use attribute's important. It says, what do I use as the index for this key? So I'm telling it to use the employee ID attribute as the index. In this case, I'm making a key over the same elements, employee elements, but I'm using the social security sub-element as the index. How do I know that this one's an attribute, this one's a sub-element? Well, this one has an at sign. At sign means attribute. This means relative to the employee, find me a social security element. Here we have a template which is using that key. So we have a value of, we're getting a value of, then we do a select, we find the key. I'm going to look in the employee's key for employee E983021. I have called employees. Yeah, there we go. The first key there was named employee. So it's going to find me an element somewhere in the document that was a type employee and that had an employee ID attribute of E983021. And I could have also done this by doing // employee square bracket at employee ID equals the string. But the difference is that this is pre-computed, all of the things, and I'm only asking it to look up something in the pre-computed index. So it's more efficient. It's also syntactically simpler to say than doing that full query from the root. And finding an element with a particular attribute and so forth.
Can you just write something?
Good. Can you iterate over the keys?
No. You can only look things up in there.
So a key function only returns one node. So
just... That's right. Key function returns one node. Here we have a value of, again, we're looking up, in this case I'm using again the employees, but the difference is that the thing I'm looking up comes from that at emp ID element of the current person element. So I'm looking, this should really be on each person, because I think it's the person that has the emp ID attribute. So yeah, it should be potion on the potion element inside the department. I want to take this, I want to find it from this, the thing that it will push to. So this is 98302 is will push to that one, and this one will push to that one. I'm not really doing anything special down here, I'm just combining two features we already know how to use. One is how to refer to an attribute of the current element, and now we're going to use it with a key. So when I use a current attribute as a key, like a foreign key in a database sense, into some list of elements, I'll flow in the document. Okay. I don't think this is a really important feature. We'll go into in any detail, but if the output of the if you want to generate let me just think about this for a second. If you want to generate XSLT from within XSLT, then you'll that whenever you say XSL colon foo, it's going to think you mean to do foo as opposed to output foo, right? That's the problem with using elements for both literals and instructions. If you need to get around that problem, then there is a feature called namespace aliasing that will help you out, but it's not very often the case. I worry about that, like it's not that common. Use XSLT to generate XSLT. But as you know, the feature's available. You can look it up if you need to learn more about it. Okay, so strip space, someone asked about stripping space. I'm sorry if some of these slides are getting cut off, but I didn't notice that when I was coming in. Strip space will strip off the white space from particular specified elements. So you put this at the top level of your style sheet, you say, strip all the white space from address elements and date elements on input. And it will, when it sees them, if they have white space leading or trailing, it will strip out those white space nodes from those elements. And what I'm doing down here, what you can't see, is just exactly the same as this, except it's an asterisk. So it means all elements. Strip space from all elements, just put an asterisk. If preserve space, so if you had done that strip space asterisk and you wanted to preserve space on a couple, then you could do that with this. So yeah, that's stuff on preserve space. Okay, so on to the next set of advanced features. Output management again, these are things there's so many options here, we can't go into them in a lot of detail. This is output, XSL colon output. So we've alluded to this a couple of times. You can use the method attribute to say that you want it to be an XML syntax or HTML syntax or raw text. And we talked a little bit about what raw text means this morning. You know, if you have less than signs, or we can test as less than signs instead of being scaled on output. Version allows you to say which version of those things you're using. So you can say XML 1.0. If there's ever an XML 1.1, you can say you want XML 1.1, but for now there's only one version of XML, so you leave that blank. Encoding is what XML encoding you want. the output that you need to use. Typically, it would be, it would default to UTF-8. You can tell it specifically what output encoding you want. You can tell it whether you want to have an XML declaration or not. By default, it would output an XML declaration. The XML declaration is a hack in it called the standalone declaration that nobody uses. But if you happen to specify it, there's an attribute for that. If you have a doc type statement at the top of your XML, if you want a doc type statement at the top of your XML, you can specify the public and system of the doc type statement. If you want to force certain elements to have C data sections as the content instead of regular text, these are all kind of esoteric XML features. If you don't know about them, then consider yourself lucky, don't worry about it. But if you happen to know about them and need to deal with them, then you can do a lot of features in XSL for doing that. Indents is pretty simple, just you want it, the tags indented in a kind of nice pretty printing way or not, as you know. And media type is like if you were going to, you had an XSLT voice that you're built into your web server or something, and you wanted to output some particular MIME type as a content type header, then you would specify the media type. Again, that's not used that much because most of the time, the binding between the XSLT engine and the web server is not that tight.
You create multiple applications?
That's a good question. No. Yes. Sort of. No, not in a standard way in XSLT 1.0. Yes, in virtually every XSLT engine in a non-standard way. Yes, in XSLT 2.0, which is right now just a draft, not actual, you know, standardized implemented language. Okay. So XSLT allows you to output messages to sort of debugging statements or warning statements to the user that something was not correct in the input documents. So you could say, for instance, if test, here I'm using that not function we discussed, if there is not a var element inside of a pool element inside the document, then just output this message. Surely you need a pool var. Okay, so all it means is output this message. Fallback is not really necessary yet. When there is an XSLT 1.1 and you want to be able to specify what happens when the when it's processed in a 1.0 engine, so if an XSLT 1.1 document is processed in XSLT 1.1, you can have a fallback, which is another way of trying to handle whatever you were trying to do in the 1.1 feature. But there is that's not really necessary right now. Okay, so that's we already did this section on advanced XPath features. So we did actually get to the slides more quickly than I thought. But we have a few minutes for questions. Maybe about more practical issues like where to get XSLT engines and where to find books in it and so forth. So I'll just take the questions for a few minutes. Mr. Tyler?
How can I produce other output formats like PDF or RTF?
Well, if your engine is allowed to add extra features like that, so you could have a PDF output format in a particular engine. But if you don't, well, RTF is text, so you could use text. And PDF, you're kind of out of luck, unless your engine has a special feature for it, because PDF is a mix of text and binary. There's nothing you can, it's like that question I addressed before about handling binary. I would say, figure out what the basic concepts of PDF are, generate an XML vocabulary for it, and then do some kind of post-process to do the actual binary jump.
There's a PR module there.
Okay. So there's a pull module that will go from XML to PDF.
Yeah,
that's true. FOP is another way of doing it. FOP, the formatting objects, yeah, I mean, they're not, I was thinking more going directly to PDF. If you know what PDF you need as output, then you might find that FOP does not have the exact features you need to map. You follow? Maybe I'm making it more complicated than it should be, but if all you need to do is generate PDF, then you should probably go through FOP is a good way to do it. But if you're an expert on PDF and you need some particular bits pattern, you know, then you need to use a more sophisticated technique.
Okay.
Other questions? Curious whether anybody here has already done XSLT. Are there people who have done some?
No, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Simple, but
Okay, well, we can,
I have a question.
Oh, sure.
As far as, I mean, you talked about, you mentioned Komodo and,
Yeah.
There were some other ones you shared on screen. Have you, is there anything that's really popped out as being particularly good for developing this stuff?
Well, it depends what, I mean, there are different tool categories. So the Komodo and the Visual XSLT are mostly for editing and debugging XSLT. For actually, running XSLT processes, or actually generating XSLT, running XSLT style sheets over XML documents in a batch format, or in a program, you could look at, Xelon, which is the Apache project's version of XSLT, or, libXSLT, the author of libXSLT, Daniel Villar, is actually at the conference. Another, I had a list of them on one of the slides. There's 4XSLT is one that's written in Python, for use in Python, and there's one for Portal 2. There's an XSLT engine written in Portal. So sometimes you will choose based on the your surrounding programming language because it's really easy to just call that module and have it process some XSLT for you. So were you thinking more about development tools or runtime?
Development tools.
Yeah. Okay, so other than the active state ones, there's also, Stylus from Exelon Corporation is another one that's relatively popular. I think there's another one, but those are kind of the two main ones that I know about.
XML Spy?
Pardon?
XML Spy has a little bit of XSLT.
Yeah, XML Spy has a little bit of everything, and one of the little bits, yeah, is XSLT, so they can do some XPath. I don't believe they do debugging, but I think they help you to edit the XSLT and apply XPath. If you're interested in that, I'd suggest you go down to the booth. It's pretty interesting what you can do with the active space. Any other questions there? Last 9 minutes of the time? Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll be around all week so you can, if you come up with a question, give me a shout.